Unabashed.
The most unpredictable
becomes a headline.
The most volatile,
outrageous behavior,
unsubstantiated narratives,
a battle of personalities.
Welcome to Grant Tamasha, a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. I'm your host, Milan Vaishnav. Last week, the results of five assembly elections were announced, and the ruling BJP of Prime Minister Narendra Modi claimed impressive victories in four out of five contests, notching wins in Goa, Manipur, Uttarakhand, and Uttar Pradesh. In the state of Punjab, the upstart Aam Aadmi Party, or AAP, won a stunning victory that saw the demise of a whole slew of politicians with household names. The Congress Party, for its part, saw its fortunes further diminish, raising fresh questions about the party's future. To discuss the drivers of these results and the impact that they have on politics and policy, I am joined by Sunetra Chaudhary. Sunetra is the national political editor of the Hindustan Times and a veteran political analyst. She joins me via Zoom from New Delhi. So nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Milan. I think it was 2019 after the elections then, so a lot has changed. It's really great to be back.
Well, let's start with the biggest prize on offer, which is the state of Uttar Pradesh. The BJP beat back significant anti-incumbency to win a comfortable majority. Its alliance won around 273 seats, so that was 50 fewer than in 2017, the last election, but enough to sail through without any issue. Its main rival, the SP, or the Samajwadi Party, and its allies claimed about 125 seats, which was a big improvement, but not enough to turn the tide. I want to ask you a little bit about what you think played out on the ground, because many analysts looked at this election, spent time on the ground, many of your own reporters, and thought, you know, this could be a close fight. But in the end, it ended up being quite one-sided. What do you think put the BJP over the edge, as it were?
Well, you know, I think that we've all been thinking about it. And I was just reading lots of friends and a lot of people are getting their hair out saying that how could so many people get it wrong? But I think I have a clue to that. This number of how much BJP would be set back because they've been in power and it's anti-incumbency, the figure turned out to be 50. Actually, when we were speaking to people in the campaign and going into the elections, the ones who were really honest and speaking off the record, the number that they would always tell you is 100. And the thing about that number, which many BJP leaders told us, and this is when people were traveling over there, the people who were number crunching, the thing about that number of 220 is the one that many people kept talking about, is that they said that if it is 210 or 220, and, you know, that they felt was a fair, because it had been a tough last couple of years, the whole thing about COVID and the fact that, you know, all those images you would have seen internationally of people, of all the bodies down the Ganga. So they said, look, if it's been tough, so if you think about it, then if you think about 100, then the fact if it's 220, yes, it's well past the halfway mark. However, what they said was, if you have even 10 or 20 seats go this way or that, most likely everyone said that there are two things. That one, there is a fight, but we will win. So even off record, they said we'll win. But because of the fact that they expected some attrition and because of the fact that they thought that number would be around 100, they felt that if things went either way, because you give yourself that room of error, so that kind of number and the fact that they were thinking around 220 is why everybody, and especially the BJP, was cautious. Now, there's another theory, Milan, that I've heard from within the BJP as well, that the BJP, as we like to know, and as our reporting has shown throughout, unlike the Congress, they really, really, they like to make everyone, whether you're a minister or you're a party worker or you're a general secretary, they like to really make people run around. So when they felt that, look, this may be an election where, you know, people have become a little lazy, they've been in power for so long, they're also in power at the center, they might not work that hard. So the other theory about why everybody came down, they felt that this was some kind of a grand plan by Amit Shah the former UP in charge and now who is the Home Minister, but who really took over the campaign in the last 6 months. This was his way of keeping everyone on their toes. Because as we know, the thing that the BJP likes to do is, for them, the priority on voting day is get everyone out. Whenever it's been problematic for the Bharatiya Janata Party is when they don't have their carders out and about, when they're not working that hard. And so this is perhaps one of the reasons that people were kind of wary and cautious and perhaps erred on the side of caution, because they just said, look, it's going to be tough, there's going to be a fight. In the end, it turned out there's no fight at all. And the number was 265. The other thing, of course, as I said, Milan, what was really clear, even the people speaking off record, even the ones who were saying there is a fight, meaning that, you know, we have a fight in our hands, even they said that, look, the reason why we say that we will pull through is because of, you know, they felt that the numbers was simply stacked against the Samajwadi Party. They said, look at it. It's the same kind of election that we had in Bihar as well, where it's the case of an OBC party. So you have the Yadavs who also are kind of, who will also get the Muslim vote because they've consolidated all of that. But they felt they were very comfortable because the other side, which is the BJP side, was going to have, they felt, the majority of the OBCs. They were going to have the traditional vote bank as well, which is the upper caste. The Brahmins were upset, but they felt that definitely the Brahmins are not so upset that they will go and vote for the Samajwadi Party. And so they felt that all of it combined, they were in a much more comfortable position, and they were starting out with a vote base of 40%. And there was no way, and they felt there was no caste combination which the Samajwadi Party could rely on, which would put them at a disadvantage. So all of these things give them that confidence. And perhaps because they acted cautious, that is the reason why all of us kind of believe that perhaps there's a fight, but it turned out it was much easier than we thought it would be.
I want to pick up on something that you just said, which is the Samajwadi Party, in a sense, did everything that it set out to do, right? It aimed to consolidate its core votaries, who are Muslims and Yadavs. And it did that in a big way, if you believe the CSCS, you know, post-poll election data, which breaks things down at the caste level. But that simply wasn't enough to offset this kind of powerful, you know, what they call rainbow caste coalition that the BJP has constructed, which works at multiple levels. Mayawati, the head of the BSP, her party won, I think, just a single seat in the state, which was a truly, you know, abysmal showing. I mean, this was somebody who, of course, was the chief minister at one point in time. Now, many experts are looking at this fact pattern and saying this is the end of so-called Mandal identity politics in North India. Do you feel confident enough to make that statement?
I mean, you know, if by Mandal politics, are you saying that those just the parties, or are we talking about caste politics altogether? Because if you're saying...
No, I don't. I think that most people acknowledge that caste still obviously is an important shaper of political behavior. But the whole crop of parties which came out of the post-Mandal era, organized on these narrow sectarian lines, have kind of exhausted themselves, right? If they're unable to expand their reach beyond their core votaries.
Yes, but, you know, at the same time, I mean, I can see where you're going with that. But at the same time, we also see the fact that the Janata Dal United, BJP's ally in Bihar, they're in power over there. And of course, the Bharatiya Janata Party will tell you that, you know, it's our partner, but it's the one that is kind of holding us down. And we have grown much bigger than them, just like they had grown much bigger than their alliance partners in Maharashtra, which eventually led to their break. We keep hearing about that in Bihar as well, about uneasiness over there. The other thing also is the fact that if we think about it, you know, I just want to come back to the whole BSP thing, because what was fascinating is the fact that what helped Samajwadi Party really is what helped BJP vis-a-vis Samajwadi Party was that all of us talked about a lot of the caste, and we And BJP feared the fact that if it became too much about caste politics, if really the OBC factor came into place, because at the end, Milan, you would have also heard that as well, that it was all about the huge OBC vote bank. And I think since January onwards, we were all misled into thinking, making too much of a deal about Swami Prasad Maurya, Dharam Singh Saini, and all these other OBC leaders leading the Bharatiya Janata Party. And what turned out to be the thing is, of course, the fact that Anupriya Patel, the OBC leaders that they had with them, the Kurmis, and of course the Nishad Party, they've had 100% strike rate. Anupriya Patel has got all of the seats that she contested in. And just in that way, the BJP actually really worked on all of these things in such a way, and they engineered that thing. And you're right about Mayawati's party looking like it's hit the end of the road, because they've fallen by 10%. We've spoken to so many of their leaders so many of the people who were with the BSP, the voters, of course, as Mayawati herself said, that her voters have moved towards the BJP. And the Muslim voters may have gone towards Samajwadi Party, but the Dalits, and when you look at the other, the OBCs who were voting for, they all moved towards the BJP. So if we go by the fact that Mayawati's majority of her voters, because they felt that she wasn't winning, that they moved towards the BJP, that certainly looks like a worrying fact for the Mandal parties and their future as well. Because even in Bihar, which I referred to initially, even there we had that kind of worrying things, because it was the overall narrative which the BJP was talking about, which is of Hindutva, which is talking about welfare, all of that was far more enticing than the caste identity politics that these parties are talking about. So definitely, I think there is a lot of truth in what you're saying. The fact that, and I think that kind of an identity crisis is not just for the Mandal parties, but it's for all the other parties as well, right? It's for all the parties that are regional, which is why, if you think about it, the reason why Mamata Banerjee was able to overcome, and as a regional party, she was able to overcome and win over the BJP, was because she also built up on the narrative of welfare politics and saying, governance at your door. Her big tagline was Duare Sharkar, governance at your door. So she built up on all of this. And I think the BJP has been talking about the fact that, look, we are moving into a place where caste, it's much larger than caste. But yes, it is a bit of an identity crisis for all of these parties who emerged.
So before we move on from UP, let me ask you a question about a man whose name we have not uttered yet, which is the UP Chief Minister, Mr. Yogi Adityanath. If you look again at the post-poll data, some of it would suggest that this was more Modi's victory than Yogi's, in the sense that the net satisfaction levels with the central government were much, much higher relative to the state government. In fact, that was true in most of the places the BJP won. However, many voters said they were quite pleased with perceived improvements in law and order, the expansion of certain welfare schemes, rations, infrastructure gains, and so on. So as we move on from this election, where do you think Yogi fits into the conversation about the future of the BJP?
I think he's right at the center of it. I think one of the things that he has going for him is that he's so young. He's only 49 years old.
And which is a baby in Indian political terms, we should know.
Yes. I mean, Rahul Gandhi is going to be 52 this year, and he's yet to start off. And here's Yogi Adityanath already making history with the fact that he's the only chief minister of Uttar Pradesh to come back to party repeat, and of course, for the BJP to, serve out its full term. So he's already created history at 49. And of course, it's interesting how you see already the party politics playing out, as a lot of the followers that he has point out the fact that, it's his credit but others say, no, it's all Prime Minister. And I thought that that playing out really well in the kind of victory speeches and victory rallies that we've seen. But I don't think we can take anything away from Aditya Nath's achievement over here. First of all, he was handpicked, as we know, in 2017. He was handpicked by the Prime Minister. He was also someone, and we know throughout in our reporting as well, that he's someone here for the sun. He is the person who personifies the Hindutva image of the party, or it's one of its beliefs. And he totally fits into that mold. And what, you know, when we talked about, when we first started talking about this, Milan, you asked about the fact that what made many people wary about the fact that the BJP was going to win so easily. And the reason for that is that, as we've seen, that Yogi Adityanath has had trouble with his team, with the BJP workers. With, you know, there was an incident a couple of years ago when the Bharatiya Janata Party was, when many of the MLAs, about 100 MLAs, were sitting in agitation, saying that no one listens to them. So he had that kind of an HR problem with the MLAs. There are many other MPs and others who complain about the fact that, you know, they expect patronage. If you have your government in power, then you should have some say over what kind of appointments or transfers that you get. This is the kind of understanding and power dynamic that has always been there in politics. Because a bit like Narendra Modi, he also came from, you know, he was an MP, but he came directly. It was the first kind of leadership role. It wasn't like, you know, he headed up on chief level and then, you know, from an MP just being the Gorakhpur MP, he became the chief minister. So he kept having that. So many felt that they doubted the fact that they felt that, you know, that BJP was fighting with the BJP, because would the cadres, would they be a spoil sport or not? But Yogi Adityanath was always very confident of the fact that he was popular with the voters. So that is something that the BJP leadership also knew, that he also knew as well, that he felt that he could pull it off, because he was so popular with all his stuff on tough on crime image, as you said. Also the fact that, you know, they see him, you know, if they're selling him to work, then he personifies that. So because of all of this, he's kind of now, he hasn't been handpicked anymore. He's proved his mettle. He's become all of that. And many say that by the time, because as we know, by 2024, Modi is going to be 75 years old. If you go by the old, if you go by old precedents in BJP, many people are given, they kind of retire, they need to retire at 75. So the leadership question certainly becomes very, very relevant. And people did forget the fact that, yes, Prime Minister Modi did come and campaign a lot in the last week as well. And also in December, he did his whole speech of campaigning over there. But he did it with Yogi Adityanath. I mean, you can't forget those images. Middle of the night in Varanasi, Prime Minister Modi walking around with Yogi Adityanath. So it was seen as a partnership, and in the end, if they won, it's a partnership that has won.
Hey, Grant the Masha listeners, thanks for listening to the podcast. Putting this show together each week is a labor of love, but it takes a lot of work to put out a great show every week. If you'd like to support the work we do at Grant the Masha, please visit ceip.org/donate. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on your favorite podcasting platform, so you'll be the first to know when a new episode rolls out.
Just to shift gears for a second, I can't help but ask you about the Congress. Now, the Congress distinguished itself in a way by its irrelevance in UP, but also in several other states. The CWC, the Congress Working Committee, met on Sunday to conduct a postmortem. In a press statement earlier, Rahul Gandhi had said the party had many lessons to learn from the results. What do we know about what took place at Sunday's meeting, and how much does it really matter given where the Congress is right now? They only have two chief ministers. Their numbers in the Rajya Sabha are dwindling. We know that their numbers are already quite depressed in the Lok Sabha. What do we know about how the party is regrouping?
Okay, first let me tell you about what really happened yesterday. And of course, it was quite hilarious because it was along expected lines. You had Sonia Gandhi coming there with Rahul Gandhi and Priyanka Gandhi, and in their opening statement, she referred to the fact that she and Rahul and Priyanka were willing to make any sacrifice that was necessary in order for the greater good of the party. Now, why, this kind of made everyone do an eye roll was because of the fact that just 2 days ago, we all had the rumors that this was going to happen, that there was going to be a resignation drama. But Congress put out a very kind of vehement statement denying that there was any kind of resignation in the air. And yet, of course, it happened. But what's also significant about the Congress Working Committee meeting that took place on Sunday evening is the fact that it kind of symbolized the greater problem that the party is facing. They are surrounded, these are the top decision makers of the party, and the fact that they didn't emerge out of it with any kind of change, just talking about another meeting where they're going to talk about the issues, just made everyone realize that, look, the Gandhis, who are the leadership of the party, who are taking the decisions right now, they've surrounded themselves with people who say very flattering, nice things and who are not willing to make the kind of change that is required. Now, second part of your question about why does it matter? Well, of course, as we know and as we've all been reporting, the reason why the Bharatiya Janata Party loves to and wants the Congress to stay there and doesn't want to kill it off, as many people said, is the fact that in so many of these seats, I think it's about 180 odd seats, 185 seats, that's more in North India, the Congress and BJP are directly in a contest. And so, for example, we're going to see Gujarat elections. Gujarat, the AAP is barely there, so it's going to be a direct fight. Himachal Pradesh, also this year, is going to be a direct fight. So that's where it becomes important. If you have a bipolar election in all these places, then you have to care about the opposition and what they're doing. And you know, Milan, the strange part of it is that while we've all been talking about the BJP style of working since 2014, where Narendra Modi wins 4 out of 5 states, and you know, he wins despite the odds and despite anti-incumbency, and next day he's doing an election rally. Well, it's like an election rally in Gujarat, which faces polls. Whereas the Congress still doesn't have its team ready for the BJP. Who is going to be the face over there? We have no idea. Who is the team over there? We don't know. In fact, it's been a bit of a free fall, the Gujarat's team, ever since Ahmed Patel, who was Sonia Gandhi's PA, ever since he died of COVID in 2020. And so, you know, it's really kind of symptomatic of the problem that the Congress is facing, that they haven't really got all of this sorted. And this is one of the reasons that they lost something that everyone assumed was their election to win, which was Uttarakhand, because there the BJP was also in a free fall. And let's not forget that in places like Gujarat in 2017, the Congress came very close to winning. Yeah, so... But, you know, that's the story of the Congress.
There are many columnists, analysts who have looked at the Aam Aadmi Party's victory in Punjab and the size of its rout, and not to mention the size of its victory last time in Delhi, to say, okay, given the way the Congress is going, the AAP is well positioned to take over some of that opposition space. There'll be other claimants too, like Mamata Banerjee and the Trinamool. There'll be, you know, other folks who want to put their hat in the ring. But clearly, you know, now running two states has a legitimate play to make. I guess my question to you is, as you look at the op, and of course, based in Delhi, you can see them up close and personal, what are some of the challenges or hurdles that they're going to have to jump in order to go from what is really a provincial party with a relatively geographically circumscribed kind of catchment zone to be a larger party on the kind of the pan-Indian stage, right? We know that they have appetite to make a big push in Gujarat. They did try to make a big push in Goa, didn't work out so well for them. What are some of the things they need to consider to get from point A to point B?
I think in Punjab, the first thing is going to be the money thing. I mean, Punjab has a huge financial crisis, and I think that this has been the story for some time now. And of course, Amrinder Singh's problems weren't that much to do with finances. He was just not willing to engage at all and left the entire work to bureaucrats. But you know, Aam Aadmi Party for a long time has had a great excuse in Delhi and other places where things, you know, some the opposition in Delhi always says, and look, you know, what really has changed apart from some of these model schools that they have, what really has changed? And so they've always said that's because we are not a full state. You know, we don't have so many of the powers that you have an MCB, the civic authorities, we don't have all of that. Now they won't have those excuses anymore. So the buck really stops with them. And as someone who covered the Punjab elections in 2017, and I remember having this conversation with Amrinder Singh, and Amrinder Singh, when he came in, he said, I am going to solve the drug issue, and which is a very emotive issue because there's so many people impacted by that. He said, I'm going to solve it in 10 days. As we know, of course, that was a ridiculous claim, as a lot of politicians make. But, you know, it just showed the kind of impossibility of some of the problems that and challenges that Punjab faces. I'm sure some of the other things, for example, water, and second, the whole pollution issue. Stubble burning is a major issue, and that is something because it impacts Delhi, the pollution impacts Delhi. It gets written about a lot as well. And now one of the first things that they asked Arvind Kejriwal was, well, now you know, the so-called polluter Punjab is in your control. Right. So are we going to
complete you it? Control it?
Yeah. So, but I'm sure somehow, because politicians are really good with that, there's also a third state at play. So maybe they can still blame Haryana for some of the pollution. So I would be surprised about that. But you know, these are a few things. There is also this whole thing about Maan, Bhagwan Maan, this fascinating, really out of the box character who's become the chief minister now. We know that you know, even if Amrinder Singh wasn't a very hands-on chief minister, he had experience, and of course he had an adoring crowd of supporters because of the fact that, you know, he was a war veteran. And he had experience dealing with the power structure and establishment. We know how important that is. I think the big challenge for Aam Aadmi Party government is going to be to negotiate their way with the bureaucracy and making them deliver on all the promises that they have. They've promised them that they are going to get them this Mohalla clinic, the community clinics, which are so, so popular and which has been their calling card and which they've promised a lot during the election campaign. But to establish that, they really need the help of all bureaucrats. So with someone like with Bhagwan Maan, who is basically a former comic and who made his way up because of the fact that, you know, he is the outsider guy, and everyone wanted, non-establishment people. That's why we've seen so many newcomers do well in Punjab elections. But it is after all the celebration is done for Aam Aadmi Party, they will really have to make it work, because out of that comes the whole prospect of and the promise of them doing well in perhaps Gujarat and other parts of the country as well. So this is their challenge of making themselves from being a provincial party, as you said, to a national party. They have to make Punjab work.
So, Sunitha, before I let you go, I want to ask kind of about two implications of what's happened. And maybe we can start with the politics first. we have presidential elections coming up. We have Rajya Sabha elections coming up. We have some state polls coming up. How is the BJP feeling about its positioning with respect to all three?
I think they're feeling very, very optimistic. This win has been great for the carers, it's been great for their workers, and it's something great for them to go into all these elections with. That's why perhaps Narendra Modi said as part of his victory speech that, you know, it just puts us in a pole position. But we have to understand that when you speak to a lot of these opposition party leaders, you see them stepping up their activity as well. They're not being like Rahul Gandhi. We saw since last year, Prashant Kishore start rallying everyone together. So all these meetings between Sharad Pawar, and KCR from Telangana, all these kind of, you know, constant posturing that we see from M.K. Stalin in Tamil Nadu, Pinaray Vijayan also in Kerala. M.K. Stalin, very interesting, you know, this entire thing about the Ukraine students, M.K. Stalin in Tamil Nadu said, you know, we managed to get the students there out of Ukraine ourselves. You know, and it's an issue which Narendra Modi really wanted to convey to his vote bank as well, because we saw that feeling in the latter part of the campaign. So we see the opposition leaders, especially Mamata Banerjee and the southern leaders, southern chief ministers, become really, really active. So the question and the story that I'm working on right now and will be for the next couple of months is basically, will the opposition all gang up against the Bharatiya Janata Party? My colleague who works with all the numbers over here told me that basically before the elections, the BJP had, of course, a majority of the vote. We had 51%. Now, because of the elections and because in several places the numbers have gone down, so they're now down to 48.6%. Now, that's not a huge problem for them. If they have the friendly parties, which are the YSR parties, the Biju Janata Dal, they've always been the ones who say that they're equidistant. But as long as that they're given some kind of promise of help locally, then they've always tangled with the BJP. So if that happens, they should be fine. But I think we are going to see a lot more of those meetings held up and a lot more posturing from these people. So all of this ensures, and because they're 48%, they will definitely need outside help. So if that happens, it's going to be a really exciting election.
So final question really quickly. You know, you spoke a little bit about what to expect on the political front. But again, as someone in Delhi who is watching what's happening in Parliament, do we have any sense of what the BJP wants to do now with its newfound stature, right? I get this question a lot. They have the numbers to push their legislative agenda. They have the mandate from the people they believe. Are there items that are on their to-do list that you think they are going to push in the next year or two leading up to 2024?
Well, you know, I thought it was fascinating that, and one of the election reforms that the Prime Minister has talked about a lot, and I thought it was fascinating on Counting Day, that the only headline that I saw emerging from the Election Commission was the Election Commissioner, Chief Election Commissioner, Sushil Chandra, saying that he thought one nation, one election was a great idea. Of course, that needs a change in amendment in the Constitution, for which they need 2/3 majority. But I think that this is something that the BJP has talked about ever since they got this kind of an overwhelming mandate. And I think this could be one of the things that they will definitely focus on, because, you know, they talk about the fact, and I think Narendra Modi was talking about it recently as well, in his, I think it was the parliament speech, where he said that, look, people blame us, for saying that, you know, we're always in election mode. I'm okay with having a once in 5 years election. And that is something, of course, that the states are really opposing. But if they need that constitutional amendment and the 2/3 majority, if anyone can perhaps negotiate their way around it, BJP.
My guest on the show this week is Sunetra Chaudhary. She is the national political editor of the Hindustan Times. Sunetra, you have been watching this in great detail. We look forward to coming back as the march to 2024 now formally begins and getting a sense from you about how things are progressing. Thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Thank you for having me, man. Thank you.
Grant Thamasha is a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. This podcast is an HT Smartcast original and is available on htsmartcast.com, India's fastest growing podcasting platform. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review. It helps others find the show more easily. For more information about the show and to find the writing we reference on this week's episode, visit our website, grantthamasha.com. Production assistance comes from Caroline Duckworth. Tim Martin is our audio engineer, and Cliff Jayapranada is our executive producer. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
This was a Hindustan Times production, brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.